Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our conversation continues with Jenny Main, CFO at the Office of Financial Stability within the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Also joining us from IBM is Jeff Smith. Jenny, you've mentioned a couple of times the terms preferred stocks and warrants. It's a little unusual when you think of the government, and especially federal finance. Could you define what they are and maybe give us a description of them?
Sure. I think probably the best way to understand them is in the context of broader investment options. And, you know, if you had a friend who's going to start a business, you want to help them. You could provide assistance in a variety of ways, right? You could say, okay, I'm just going to give them a grant. Here's $1,000. No strings attached. Just take the money. Or you could do a loan that says, here's $1,000. Let's agree on some terms. You're going to pay me back. You need the money now. I don't need it, but you can pay me back later, and we'll agree on when you're going to pay me and how much. Then there's the straight equity option, we would call it, where you'd say, okay, to your friend, here's $1,000. It's going to help you start your business. But you know what? When you start to make some money, I want you to give me a percentage of it. Maybe give me 5% of your profits when you're done. So those are kind of the typical range of forms you could have, sort of, you know, everything from no strings attached to, hey, I want a part of your business. What preferred stock is it's kind of a hybrid in the middle. Preferred stock says, I'm going to invest in the company, I'm going to own stock in it, but I want to have some fixed terms about this. I want to get specific payments, dividend payments they're called, and you agree ahead of time on the coupon, how much the rate is that you're going to get paid. Unlike a loan, it doesn't say you're going to make these payments to pay me back at certain times. In fact, it doesn't even have an end date on it. It says pay me back when you feel like it, you can redeem the preferred stock, or alternatively, if I decide to sell it to someone else, then I could get my money back out. But in the interim, I'm going to get a fixed amount on it. So that's really what preferred stock is. And the government has invested, purchased preferred stock from these big financial institutions. So they say, I get an opportunity to get dividends on these. It's in effect interest earned, but there isn't a fixed end point. A couple other things that are important to note. Preferred stock is preferable, I think, for a government investment or taxpayer investment in these companies because it's not voting. The government really is a reluctant shareholder, is the phrase we use. It doesn't want to be influencing the private decisions by these companies. So the preferred stock has that extra removal. It also has the protection that if a company actually does go bankrupt or default, the preferred stock shareholder gets their money back before a common stockholder. That's generally what you're getting with preferred stock. The warrant concept comes in because the preferred stock approach, you don't have as much risk as the common stockholder because you would get your money back first in the risk of default, but you don't have any what we call upside potential. If the company starts to do really well, your preferred stock is still only worth the value, the basic value that you paid, is the par value it's called. So you don't have the upside that the common stockholder does. So the notion of the warrant was really to help protect the taxpayer and make sure that if any of these investments, these companies actually started to do a lot better, that we would have some upside potential for the taxpayer. So what the warrant says is it's the right to buy the common stock at a particular price. So if common stock is currently trading at $100 a share and you have the right to buy it at $50 a share, that's what the warrant is. It would be the right to buy it at $50 a share. That warrant is actually quite valuable because every one of those you can make $50 right off the top. So when the government invested in these preferred stock investments, they said you need to give us a warrant share as well. They create what's called a strike price, which is what the right to buy it at is called, the strike price. So last fall, all this $125 billion that I mentioned earlier that was invested, each of these companies, the government, the taxpayer, got warrants, the right to buy the stock at a certain price. So, you know, following that through, you might think, well, we don't actually want to buy the common stock. We said in the beginning we don't want to buy the common stock. But what we do really is get the warrants, and the warrants themselves then have value. We can sell them to other parties who would want to use the right to buy a stock at $50 a share when it's trading at $100, for example. So those warrants then have value in themselves if the prices of the companies, the stocks of the companies go up. And as we've seen over the last year, the value of the stocks, of many of the financial institution stocks to date, have gone up, certainly since last year. And so those warrants are what we call in the money, meaning that, you know, if you have a warrant to buy a share for $150 a share and it's trading at $100, you know, who really cares? It's not worth so much, although it might in the future, so it might still have value. But it's an obvious call. You're in the money if you can buy it at $50 or $90 today and it's really worth $100. So those are the concepts. And they really have, as you say, very new to government, not what we're traditionally used to, but that's what they're about.
So switching gears a bit, talking about improper payments, reducing improper payments is a major factor in federal agencies' ability to fulfill their obligation to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse, and to use taxpayer dollars appropriately. First, what are improper payments, and would you tell us about your efforts to successfully manage and reduce improper payments at Small Business Administration? What lessons would you share with your colleagues?
Improper payments are an interesting topic. What I think of it as the kind of the black and white area of, you know, obvious cases of fraud and other just obvious ineligibility. So the concept of the improper payment is someone got a payment that they shouldn't have. Easy examples, a Social Security payment that accidentally you make three payments to the same person for the same amount. That's obviously an improper payment. That person should have gotten one payment for whatever the amount was. Payments to people who are deceased and are no longer eligible for the program is another sort of obvious black and white case. The government has made a lot of progress over the last, you know, 5 years, 10 years, particularly at Social Security Administration and others, to ensure that we're not paying, you know, these obvious kind of either fraud or just erroneous payments. The area that I dealt with, and so going to the Small Business Administration, the disaster program, which has a lot of payments to, you know, local small borrowers, you know, individuals, not so much businesses, both actually. The disaster program was the most common place where you'd sort of see some of the fraud activity, people who would falsify tax returns or things like that. And SBA was very aggressive about going after them, the Inspector General. You know, every year there would be plenty of activity in that front, identifying those kinds of things. The area that gets tougher, that I think is important, but it's really challenging, is when it's more a question of whether the participant really or the beneficiary really complies with the program requirements. So if we go back and we say, you know, to be eligible for this funding, you have to meet these certain criteria. We might say to the bank, you have to look, when you underwrite these loans, you have to look at these 15 things. And if you don't look at those 15 things, we might not pay you because you, if you had looked at them, you might not have made the loan. And then we wouldn't have had the default, for example, that we're currently paying on. And that area is a lot grayer. We found it challenging. It's very important, but it's challenging because sometimes it is up to interpretation where, you know, one group might say, well, we think this is eligible within the criteria of the program. And, you know, the Inspector General or someone might come along and say, nah, we don't agree. That was the hardest area. So, you know, kind of the obvious solution to that is, well, let's be more specific and let's get more clear about what qualifies and what doesn't. On the one hand, that's appealing because budget and accounting world, we like black and white. But on the other hand, some of these, especially in the credit arena, are actually more judgment calls about whether it's appropriate or not. You know, whether the whole package hangs together and you feel okay, you're missing one document, but you have other things that you think are compensating, you know, do you have the leeway to make that decision? So we continued to, at SBA, really try to work with the folks who were actually doing, for example, reviewing these 7A, their big guarantee programs, the Section 7A program, and making payments to lenders for this. But it was a difficult area because the more black and white we got about it, the less flexibility there was, and so it was a tension between those things. I was in an interesting conversation on healthcare reform, the same exact topic. Are some of the payments made out improper if someone prescribed several different screenings and additional things? If you were like technically allowed to under the rules, but you really didn't need to, you're only doing it because there was a financial incentive to, you know, where do you start to think about that being an improper payment? Where should the line go? And those, I think, are the really challenging ones. I'm very pleased that the government's made a lot of improvements just using technology to identify fraud and those kind of things for the black and white cases. You know, Danny Werfel, the comptroller nominee at the OMB, is, you know, was very focused on continuing to make a lot of good progress there. But I find the harder one are these sort of what's program eligibility, you know, and really clarifying that and judgment areas. Yeah. So that's been, you know, that's kind of been my experience with it.
When you were at SBA, you were designated as the Performance Improvement Officer, a position created by executive order in the previous administration. What responsibilities did that entail, and how critical is the establishment of such a position?
Well, this was actually a really interesting experience for me when I was at SBA. I worked for the long-standing administrator for several years. The last couple of years I was there was Steve Preston. And he had actually had a focus on the performance improvement area even before the executive order came out in the November of 2008, I think it was, 2007, that created this performance improvement officer position. So really the key focus there was both thinking about how are we measuring the effectiveness of the organization and the programs? You know, how well do they achieve what their mission is? That's kind of the traditional way of thinking about it. And then linking that all the way back, if you sort of ascribe to this notion that you need to have a very clear set of objectives and goals for the organization and when I say organization, could be at every level, from the biggest level all the way down narrowly. It has to be very clear what you're trying to achieve, and then you translate that into to specific strategic objectives. And they translate that down to people who really understand, here's what I'm after and what I do each day makes a difference. And then you go all the way to holding individuals and organizations accountable for accomplishing those results. So Steve Preston really ascribed to that big picture. That's how he wanted to run the organization. And he brought me in as the CFO, but expanded my responsibilities around this performance area. I was actually the associate administrator for performance management was my second title with the CFO. And the notion was to really think through, are we running the organization along these principles? And I think the key thing that I would say that to me that was most interesting was that we focus less on the question of how effective our programs are directly. And I know that's a little bit sort of heresy, but in SBA's case, most of these programs are more than 50 years old, and Congress really likes them. So, you know, the notion that we were going to change major changes in the programs themselves was actually not on the table so much. So we really focused on the question of how good of a job are we doing executing these programs? What do we know about how long it takes us to process applications, to get these things done, to look at improper payments? How much time are we spending reviewing these things, and what's the cost benefit of what we identify? So we really dug into those kinds of questions around the performance of the operations of the programs. And I think it was a very valuable lens to look at the operations through. And it was also, this is kind of a strange tie, but it was really empowering for the folks who work there. We really stepped back and said, what we do and how we execute these really matter. Right. And we tried to create this, you know, broader understanding across the staff of what the objectives were and what we're trying to do. And I want to, you know, sort of brag a little bit about this because I think it was a terrific outcome. If you go back in 2006, SBA employees ranked at lowest on the survey of places to work. It was like 30 out of 30 or 29 out of 30. It was not in a terrific place. And by 2008, so Steve Preston came in that summer of 2006, and we really embarked very quickly on this broader effort. Yeah. And by the summer of 2008, when the survey was redone, SBA moved up 30% in its you know, ranking and its score, and won one of the awards for most improved in terms of employees' satisfaction of places to work. And I really think a big part of it was bringing a sense of meaning and purpose to what they were doing, that how they went about their business, their work really mattered and made a difference. So I'm a big believer that performance improvement, the concepts around performance improvement are really critical. And like I said, I've actually seen them, I feel like, have a major impact on an organization.
We hear a lot now of days. It may be considered the age of transparency and accountability. But when you think of financial information being critical to program delivery, how has the CFO role evolved within the federal government, getting a seat at the table, so to speak?
I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, I'm obviously a bit biased by my own experience, which has been, as I mentioned before, really a neat opportunity to bring kind of the CFO data and view, analytical view of the world, into the broader management of the organization. I do think that this is kind of where a lot of the future is going. Certainly, I'm also a bit sensitized by working at the TARP, where we've really tried to step back and say, what kind of information do we have? What kind of data do we have? We have a lot of reporting requirements, and yet we sort of have a gap of people saying that they're not getting, you know, enough, or there was a period where people felt like they weren't getting enough information about what we were doing, where we were actually posting, you know, we're required to post every transaction we do within 48 hours on the financialstability.gov website. So no other agency, you know, has that level of reporting requirements. We do a monthly report to Congress with all of our activity, as well as a $50 billion tranche report, we call it, every time we hit a $50 billion obligation level. So I've been thinking about this issue of how much data and information is out there versus how you communicate it and really help people understand what does it mean and kind of drawing these lines. And I think the CFO function is really critical to it, partly because we tend to be major players in the data ownership and collection just with the financial systems. A lot of these are financially related data. And secondly, the accountability reporting that we do, the performance accountability reporting, where I've been, the CFO's had a major role in that process. And those are the places we're trying to get to, more sort of citizen-centric reporting and thinking about not so much what do we want to say, but more what do people want to know? What are they interested in? And how can we present it at a level that that will inform them, keep their attention, and otherwise, you know, provide useful information and that's accurate. I'm also a big fan that the government has to be capable of saying, this is what we're trying to do, and here's what we're succeeding at, and here's what we're not. We have to be honest about saying, these are the challenges that we're struggling with, and here's what we're doing about them, we're trying to do about them. I think until you see those kind of statements in documents, people are skeptical that you're really, you know, it's like, oh, it's just all rosy stuff. You have to find ways to be honest and candid about what's out there. And it's a tricky thing to do, but to me, it's a critical one.
What does the future hold for the Office of Financial Stability? We will ask Jenny Main, CFO at the Office of Financial Stability within the U.S. Department of the Treasury, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.